advise you to get off the streets as quickly as possible. It'll soon be a war up there.
And we are, as a people, opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths.
I know for a fact.
And to secret proceedings.
Weapons of mass destruction.
I have a dream.
I take the threat very seriously.
A new world order.
Your government thanks you for your participation.
You are now listening to the world-famous Sofa King Podcast.
Please, read from sheets. I am Sofa King.
Sofa King.
Now repeat all very fast, please.
I am Sofa King.
Faster.
I am Sofa King.
No, not so fast. Loses meaning.
I am Sofa King with me, Todd.
You say funny things.
I'm surprised. Last episode, we were talking about getting a cease and desist letter from Gary Coleman's family.
Yes.
I'm surprised we haven't got one from Danger Doom or anybody for the intro.
Oh, yeah.
That's what?
That'd be knocking on wood.
Oh, you're knocking on wood?
Yeah.
I didn't ring the bell this time when Brent drank. He looked at me.
Oh, I don't have an OCD or anything. It doesn't bother me.
Okay.
And last time you rang it twice, and yep. I think you ringing it twice fucked him up more than not ringing it.
Yeah. No, I've been driving the circles around the Garson Circle with my radio on
off.
10. Yeah.
Oh, on 10. Oh.
Off.
So, all right. So we got some saddening news. We lost some sponsors. We lost a good sponsor we've had for a very, very long time. Parted paths. But good news is we got a new sponsor. Brent, who is it?
El Yucateco Hot Sauce.
So yes. Thank you for sponsoring us. They're going to take a chance on giving us.
If you guys haven't heard of it, I think I may have mentioned it like maybe once in the past because I'm a fan of Yucateco Hot Sauce. Mm-hmm. But that is our new sponsor. You should definitely check them out. You can log onto their website. It's sold in most major grocery stores. And I think even Target and Walmart.
They have it on their site. And they actually hooked us up with a coupon code, Sofa King. You get 10% off. You order it from their website at lyucateco.com.
Yeah. I'm excited to try it.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully they'll send us some stuff pretty soon. we can get to try it. So that's pretty good.
There's cases of it behind me right
now. Oh, it already got here.
There's hats everywhere.
You kind of turned into Nicolas Cage a little bit right there.
It's because my mind's fried.
There's cases of it behind.
What happens when you drink Red Bull and it brings you up and then you drink Modelo Negro and whiskey?
What'd you call me?
Negro.
Sorry.
The River Niger, man. It runs right through the Middle Egypt, man.
I do have to give a shout out to a couple of people for feeding a habit of mine. My world has changed this week. First shout out
to Imodium AD
to Sid Melvin because apparently he was driving back into town from somewhere and he saw that they had Faygo Red Pop and he bought me a bottle.
Oh, you have to hook up on Red Pop. Shot.
So I got a Faygo and I was very happy about it. And listener Carson Ramirez posted a picture on Instagram of him holding a Faygo Red Pop, like a 23-ounce plastic bottle, and it said, finally got to try it, whatever. And I wrote back and said, hey, where did you get it? And he said, Fast Trip, which is a local, like a convenience store chain. He said, the Fast Trip on 34th and Q.
Oh, he's like, from here. They carry local. It.
I was like, fuck off. No way. So I drove down there yesterday.
And it's in the ghetto.
And I walked in.
It's right next to Cobra.
It's the ghetto Fast Trip. It's the ghetto Fast Trip. It really is.
It's the one you don't leave your car running.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Three people hit me up for money on the way from my car to the door. I get in there like the what you just drink.
Ooh, I forgot about that one.
It's smoky.
That the cask aisle.
Yeah.
So it is smoky. That hit me.
I go into the soda section and there's like a weird little like on the inside of the glass door. There's a little thing where four bottles of Faygo are hanging, so it's not actually shelved in the thing. It's like on
just
the door
four at
itself.
A time.
And there's one Faygo Red Pop, and then there was like Rock and Rye and Ohana Punch and like some horrible cream soda. I picked up the one fucking Red Pop, and I was like, holy shit! And I walked up to the front, and I was like, do you guys have any more of this? So there's like one bottle. She's like, yeah, we have a whole bunch of it, but it's not cold. And I was like, where is it? And it was like at an
I have
cap.
A refrigerator, bitch.
Yeah, exactly. But there's an end cap and there's just all this fucking Faygo. And I just like, I turned into like Scrooge McDuck in my, in me money bin. And I just scooped up all the fucking Red Pop I could carry and set it down.
You're like in a dream. Huh?
No, yeah, I was. I was like, really, this is not right fucking. Now? And then, but I was like, so they probably got a single shipment. I'm going to buy as much as I can. And then they're out. And I was like, so is this like a one-time thing? And she was like, no, honey, we always carry Faygo Red Pop.
That's funny.
She was like, no, we always carry Faygo. And she was like, it's funny though, because everybody just comes in and randomly buys all of them. But it's like you and this other lady and a handful of people, they come in and they just buy out all the Red Pop and they get all crazy about it.
You're gonna be fighting.
I was like, I am.
You're gonna run in there and you're gonna run into the other person.
I'm a punch a bitch for some Red Pop.
Just not. She's on got Wednesday. One leg.
So yeah, no, yeah. She was like, no, we always carry it. We get a regular supply. So
it's gonna
I have
be some bum.
I have a local Faygo Red Pop supply. I'm very, very happy about it. I don't know that I can drink a 23 ounce bottle of Faygo Red Pop. Because that's a bit
money. You know, because I thought about it a lot. I was like, man, should we pursue Faygo as a sponsor? But I'm not big on like sugary drinks and whatnot. Yeah. But they do have, Faygo has sparkling water. I went to their website and they have the craziest cool color grid. They have like weird flavors like gold. 60/40.
Well, that's why red. Is red really? Yeah. Is red strawberry? What flavor is it? There's a whole thing on that. Like, what is it?
But if anyone out there, I'm just going to throw this out into the universe. Since like we find out that like famous people listen to the podcast, that we're like, what? That guy listens to podcasts. If you're involved in marketing for some company that you think that we would be a good, you know, spot for demographic,
especially hit Faygo.
Faygo, King Cobra, you know, we don't want
things that we can do justice to and get them out of the hood. Yeah. So King Cobra.
We're not above
and the
ghetto.
Thing is, it's like, cause you know, they have Faygo in like glass bottles at BevMo for like $2.50 a bottle, which is just fucking ridiculous.
Well, when we go there, you take them a ski mask and you tell them to put it on when you're paying for it.
But at the Fast Trip, fucking 23 ounces, 90 cents, not even 99.
Yeah,
like 90. Just 90.
That's cheaper than Walmart.
That's after CRV and everything.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now that's what Faygo should cost.
We're just going to unofficially be sponsored by Faygo. We'll just push the shit out of it until they're like, who are these guys?
Why are we getting this boost in Southern California?
Yeah.
So thanks to Sid for giving me a bottle and a special thanks to Carson for tipping me off to a local supplier.
Wow.
And the
that was a
job.
Plug. Yeah. Well, there was already a plug for somebody who's not a sponsor. Yeah. So. And a hand job. Speaking of gay, Alan Turing.
Alan Turing.
segue.
Yeah, that was a good segue. So, today's topic is Alan Turing. And for those of you who don't know who he is, I think he got probably more press than he ever has a couple years ago when Benedict
Cumberbatch made
the Imitation Game movie, which I've heard is really good, but I still haven't seen.
Cumbercrotch.
It's really good. I watched it.
What is it?
Yeah.
The Imitation Game.
I've never seen it.
It's really good.
It's all is about. It about the war?
It's specifically about trying to crack the Enigma code from the Germans. Yeah. It's really good.
So Alan Turing is considered by most people to be the father of modern day computer science. Most people consider him the father of the modern day digital computer because of what he invented at Bletchley Park to help break a Nazi code.
He thought of computer programming before there was even a computer.
Yes. Yeah.
He basically mechanized an algorithm is what happened. Like he looked at it and he's like, man, there's an algorithm, but they had the Enigma machine had 159 million combinations and they changed their base code for the algorithm. So basically the algorithm every day was based off of some little settings and that changed every day.
Yeah, there's wheels. Yeah. So, but, or sometimes hourly or some, you know, daily, whatever it was a couple times a day. But before that though, he had created on paper what a computer could actually be programmed to do.
Well, the problem that they was going against is that even if they had like, I don't remember the number, but it was like if 10 guys worked 24 hours around the clock, it would take 20 million years to go through the combinations that thing was possible at 150 million, million combinations. It would still take 10 men never sleeping for 24 hours a day for 20 million years.
Right.
To try to go through all the combinations. So if they did land it, if they ever broke it through some happenstance, they were only cool until noon or whatever, and it was going to start over or midnight, and then they're going to start over. So they would only have that day. So it was never going to happen. It was unbreakable. Basically, it was the thought.
Yeah,
but he figured out.
You're talking about the code. I'm talking about something else.
He's like, can a machine beat a machine?
Jumping ahead. Jumping ahead of things.
No, that's his machine's based off of those going against those odds.
In the Enigma machine, but before that, he had created the 1 and 0 binary code, knowing that with a paper, that the computer could actually change or move based on what the paper said, which was the program basically. Mm-hmm. So that's what ended up leading into creating the code breaking for the Enigma.
And it's kind of a trip because so,
Well, explain the Enigma machine because people probably don't know what Enigma was.
Okay, so the Enigma machine is a thing that the Germans invented. And it wasn't actually invented for World War II, which I was surprised. It was invented at the end of World War One. The Enigma machine was, and it
was insane.
It's an insane machine. So they invent this machine at the end of World War One, and it was actually used by companies, German companies and the German government to encrypt things and so forth, after World War One. But apparently some Polish, cryptanalysts broke the Enigma code in 1932 because it was a more basic
the bomb.
And that was even what Turing worked on, was a thing called the bomb. So they developed a really rudimentary device that could crack the code, but then the Germans found out that they cracked the code and they revised the machine with like this infinite complexity that suddenly made it the, you know, millions of
That's how it happens. So, you add one more digit to a
and you've just changed everything.
Gets insane.
And even within the machines, like I didn't know this, they had, so they had, the reason the machine was so hard to break is, and I did my best to figure out how this fucking machine works.
Right.
Like I couldn't even get my head around the basics of it, much less figure out how to crack it. But there was a choice of, there was a bunch of rotors, which they call wheels.
There were four rotors on top.
Depending on the machine I read.
Could be more.
Army used four rotors. At the beginning of the war, they used three. They developed into four, and they said that some naval missions used as much as eight rotors. So the even the complexity of the machines themselves would just vary wildly. But the rotors were the orders, and I have a hard time even explaining what the machine does.
Well, it's basically randomizing characters, and as long as it's based off of an algorithm. So you give it, they would broadcast out at the end of the before the change, they'd broadcast, these are the new keys for the next day. So set the rotors to this, and there was some other thing on the bottom with letters that you would change too. So based off of these settings
there were
the
plugs,
rotors.
Yeah, there were plugs on the bottom. Like almost like a switchboard. So like they would each one of those, there might be like 10 on top and 10 on bottom.
Right.
And they had plugs in them and those had to be in a specific pattern along with the rotors on top being at specific letters. So like each rotor had the alphabet on it. Right. Or numbers two.
Yeah. Each rotor.
So
each
they all had to be like W, A, B, zero. And then that right there would be able to encrypt the code and it would receive the code and be able to unencrypt it.
You would just type out the message you're going to do at that point and it would randomize it. And it's not even as simple as like A is going to be Q now. It was completely crazy random based off of some super infinite mathematical algorithm of those combination of letters. It wasn't like A is not always A.
They wouldn't just broadcast out the, they would broadcast out the wheel order, the ring settings, which was the position of the alphabet, which rotors you're using. What to set them at alphabetically, plug connections, because you would plug things into the front of it.
It was
the switchboard. And they would say, so use this many wheels, set wheel one to this, wheel two to this, wheel three to this, wheel four to this, plug in these things on the switchboard. And then in late versions, they had something called a reconfigurable reflector, which they would also broadcast for. Oh, yeah. Now we're talking. And then there were also the initial position of the rotors that were chosen by the operator for each message. And they would broadcast this out, and it was completely unbreakable. No one had the machine, and
you had to have a machine.
You had to have a machine in order to do anything. Yeah.
But they got a hold of a machine.
They did get a hold of a machine, and this
the issue was they didn't have the.
They didn't have anything, right? Yeah. So, but we're getting ahead of ourselves from the
Even with that machine, though,
it was still impossible.
It was still impossible.
Yeah. So, Alan Turing, the reason that they picked him is obviously he was very fucking intelligent. He was born to two Brits that lived in India, and he was conceived in India, but they moved back to London because they wanted him to be raised in England instead of in India. But apparently, they were on contract by the government, so they had to keep going back to India, and he would stay in London with family and so forth. Obviously, he was he was in boarding schools and stuff. He was a very bright child, but apparently the schools emphasized the humanities and the classics and all this stuff. So the professors didn't really respect him.
He was so advanced that he was working on like crazy advanced mathematical equations that the professors themselves couldn't do.
No.
And he had never even taken calculus.
Right.
I don't understand.
Well, he was,
I don't know what those symbols are. You know, how do you know that? You know,
yeah, like, the theory, Einstein's theory of relativity didn't really, it wasn't called anything. Alan Turing actually gave it a name.
Right.
So like that's how advanced and in mathematics he
at
was.
Age 16.
At age 16, yeah.
At 16, he was reading Einstein and like inferring questions that Einstein had about Newtonian physics and saying, well, I think Einstein is asking this question and this question and this question about the basics of physics. And years later, Einstein published some stuff that actually my questions are this and this and this. And he figured that out at fucking 16, just reading Einstein.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the guy is just off the dials and he was hardcore about school. I read that, and this was before the war, when he was 13, there was some kind of a major labor strike, like the week that school started.
This is crazy.
And his boarding school was 60 miles away from where he lived in London, and he fucking rode his bike for two days in order to
because the buses were down for the strike.
Everything was on strike. So, I mean,
so he rode
was
his bike.
Fucking dedicated to this shit.
He was, I read he was into cycling, and I know he got into running later on.
Into running
he was
to into the point cycling. That he tried out for the Olympics, but he was injured, and his time was only 11 minutes slower than the finishing silver medalist for
Britain.
Did
he have a bum leg too?
For like 2 hours, like it was like a 2 hour and 36 minute race or something, and he wasn't that far off from the guy while injured.
Yeah.
And he otherwise he would have gone to the 1948 Olympics after he fucking did the Enigma machine and fucking invented computers. He almost became an Olympian.
Yeah. Crazy. So so he loved cycling, loved running and men.
Yes. And he was gay.
Yes.
And apparently,
and in last episode, I talked about the time period of being prosecuted for homosexual acts.
Right.
He was prosecuted for homosexual acts later in the show. We'll get into it
later in life.
But, that's crazy.
And he didn't really hide it all that much. A lot of people who were homosexual completely hid it and no one knew, but his friends and family all knew and he didn't hide it from people who were close to him.
And I guess what school is it in Cambridge or whatever that he was going to?
King's College.
I guess they were really open to it. Uh-huh.
It was more accepted there.
Yeah. It was pretty open.
And his first love was a guy named Christopher Morcom, who was at Cambridge with him, and Morcom died in 1930 by getting bovine tuberculosis
from drinking contaminated milk.
Jesus Christ. Sounds awful all the way across the board.
Yeah, they portray that pretty,
it's like the bird flu nowadays,
pretty well in that movie The Imitation.
Oh, did they
show it?
So, but yeah, he becomes named a fellow of the king, basically gets a fellowship at Cambridge in 1935 when he's like 22,
which is crazy.
What is a fellowship exactly?
It just means like if you become a fellow, it's an honor that's bestowed upon you. You're in a club. It usually means you get funding for your own research. Yeah, like you get now we would just call it a fellowship.
Right.
It tends to mean that you get money and you get to go to a very exclusive university to research and to pursue your theories. But you're basically like at this level, if you get a fellowship at Cambridge, you're like the best in the fucking world.
Yeah. Right.
Like you're as good as
and being 22 was incredibly early.
And apparently he proved, and a lot of the shit that I read about him, I was like, don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But he proved the central limit theorem, which none of his professors at Cambridge could do. And he proved it in 1922. And that's why they awarded him the King's Fellow. And it turned out that there was another person who had proved it years earlier, but no one in England knew that. But the fact of the matter is, at 22, he was smart enough to prove this shit that no one at Cambridge
could
prove.
I think they said his method was more approachable or something too. Like someone else. Whoever did it was more difficult. He still simplified it, I think.
And that was one thing that he was famous for, because even like the computational machines that he was working on later, once he gets to Bletchley Park, like he was said to have toured like American like top secret facilities to see what they were doing, and like things that he were doing that had like 8 components, the Americans had like 360 components, because that was the only way they could get to it. And Turing just figured out simpler ways to make shit happen. So he was just
they were talking about running the length of the cables diagonal so that the current ran faster, like shorter paths between connections.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about microseconds, milliseconds, like craziness. Yeah.
But that's the shit he was thinking of when no one on earth was thinking of it, right? I mean, people call him the father of computer science for a fucking reason.
Yeah.
Like he was, I mean, the architecture of your cell phone, the architecture of your fucking iPad, your fucking computer, your laptop, my fucking smart TV.
It's all based off
his thinking. It's all based on the Turing machine, which I thought wrong until this week. I thought the Turing machine was a machine that actually broke the Enigma code, but the Turing machine was a theoretical computational device that he dreamed up.
And that's what I was talking about. He wrote a paper on it, and it was basically a computer. Like he theorized the computer before there were computers.
Before there were computers. He said exactly how it had to work.
Yeah, he didn't know how to build it.
Yeah.
But he mapped it out basically.
The RAM and ROM and memory and fucking all that shit.
Well, he talked about he's like, well, we're thinking something is happening in there. Right. Like when we start to solve problems, there is a mechanism. There has to be for problem solving. And what are you actually physically doing physiologically? What's happening in your brain when you're problem solving to make a decision to come to a conclusion?
Right.
And he's right.
Which really
started to break it down through logic.
Yeah, and which really started, it kicked off when his love died, Marcom, died of the tuberculosis.
Right.
Bovine tuberculosis.
And for the record, that love, like there was no making out or anything apparently. It was just like super close friends. He loved that dude.
Right.
Didn't really know, because they were young actually. It was still pretty young. I don't know if that was a
The other guy was, the other guy was gay too.
I don't think they acted on anything though, but they like passed.
Well, they weren't sexual people. Stuff. They weren't sexual people. They were computer nerds.
Right.
Right.
They didn't even have computers. How fucking oppressed.
Yeah, they like. They would pass notes.
I'm a gay computer nerd who can't have sex with gay men, and there's no computers.
Yeah.
That's as bad as it gets. So, but yeah, he wrote in 1936 a paper called, and everybody just calls it on computable numbers. Like everyone says, he wrote his 1936 papers on computable numbers, and they stop there because the full title of it is On Computable Numbers with an Application to the Ensch-Eid-Unsch problem.
Yes.
So they just cut it off in the middle.
Dung is in there somewhere.
Yeah. So he ends up graduating from Cambridge. He flies to the States and he goes to Princeton, where he gets a PhD in mathematics and cryptology. And this is before the war has really broken out. He goes back home to London and he gets a job at the Government Code and Cipher School, which is a British code breaking organization. And while he was here, before the war even started, he wrote two papers on the mathematics of code breaking for the government that were so influential in code breaking that the British government didn't declassify them until 2012.
And they're so crazy, like fanboy status, that someone went back historically and got notes from students who attended the class that we was in, like lecture notes, and recreated verbatim the actual like interjections and questions from the professor to the student during the classes that he attended. They rewrote it out like a transcript of him attending the classes.
Wow.
Based off of other people's notes. They put it all back together to say like session
starts.
That's like
telephone though.
Yeah. No, it was, well, a little bit maybe. Like, yeah. But like, usually when you're taking notes, it says verbatim. I mean,
yeah, you can probably you'd get a decent account of it. I mean, if you got 30 people's notes all there and
I guess these are like super nerds though. They're in there.
Exactly.
Like,
they're just taking damn good notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's at this point, he's still really young. He's doing government cryptology, et cetera. And the war breaks out on September 4th, 1939. That's when the UK declares war on Germany. And on that same exact day, Turing reported to Bletchley Park, which is a very interesting thing. I mean, we had the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, as we talked about a couple of episodes ago. If you didn't listen, go back and listen. And Oppenheimer was in charge of that whole thing. Bletchley Park is kind of the big thing that the British had, except instead of trying to invent nuclear power, they were trying to invent the computer.
Yeah.
And I think everybody looks, you know, if they look at the two things, I think most people look at like the nuclear age and they think that Oppenheimer was the most influential person coming out of the war with the most influential invention. And I tend to disagree. I think that Turing's invention and what was done at Bletchley Park had a much bigger impact.
And their intent wasn't even to invent a computer.
No.
They were just like old school code breaking.
Yeah.
It was Turing that even convinced them, and it had to do an uphill battle because he wanted like £100,000 to fund the project. And they were like, get the fuck out of here. That's not how it works. So he like circumvented his commanding officer and he wrote a letter directly to Winston Churchill, and they received the letter that said, give him what he wants. He's the boss.
And actually from what I read, Churchill came. So Bletchley Park is designed for cryptography, for right. sending private messages for the British Army, for interpreting messages, for getting messages from the American Army and translating them back, spying on the Soviets, overhearing the Italians. Like, it's the all information that is encrypted is going to Bletchley Park to get decrypted or to get encrypted before it gets sent out. It's like this super important hub, probably the most important hub of British intelligence during the war. And Churchill visited it in 1941, a couple years into the war, when the Blitz is happening, London's getting bombed, all this shit. And apparently he goes in because Churchill was famous for having like really a really big wit. And he went in and I guess he was so unimpressed with the staff that he told the guy in charge, I forget his name, the commander who was in charge of Bletchley Park, he said, "I told you to leave no stone unturned to get staff, but I had no idea you had taken me so literally," because he thought everyone there couldn't type. They didn't know what they were fucking doing. And it was just like this horrible thing. And then one of the things that Turing realized is we're trying to recruit soldiers to do this stuff. And we should probably just be recruiting like math teachers and female math teachers who aren't being recruited to the war. So Bletchley Park was predominantly staffed by female math teachers.
So I don't know if this was like a...
I mean, he wrote 6 weeks later after that visit, he wrote a letter to Churchill, and Churchill said, "You're right, throw everything at Bletchley Park and get them funded."
In the movie, anyway, he made a spoiler. He made a crossword puzzle that was super crazy encrypted.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And if you could solve that crossword puzzle, you were like an amazing candidate for this program.
I didn't know that was in the movie, but yeah, I looked that up. So let me find it in my notes. Yeah, he had this crazy crossword. No, it's real.
So he pushes it out to the public.
That was his test.
Yeah. So that all these people do it. And if you can solve it, then you're going to like receive a letter because you mail it in. Like, you might have won a prize. And then if you send it in because you think you won a prize, but when you send the crossword
you
puzzle,
you just
in,
join the army.
You got a letter that says you are qualified for some top secret mission or whatever.
Right.
Show up at this place for testing. He then gave him a test that was pretty much impossible, but it took him 8 minutes to arrive at the conclusion that it was impossible. He gave them 6 minutes to try. And then one of the females who they almost kicked out, at least in the movie, because they're like, "What are you doing here? Secretaries, go upstairs," that whole thing. And he's like, "Have a seat, you're late," whatever, hands it out, and she finishes it in like 5 minutes and 34 seconds.
Right.
And that's a prominent character in history, but I don't know if that whole, "Oh, she finished the test fast" and all that.
Well, I know that crossword puzzle thing is true, because there was a guy named W.A.J. I don't know what, it's a very British name, I would imagine. W, like, I'm sure that's initials for like, you know, Wentworth, Anthony Johnstone.
Yes.
W.A.J. Gavin was the chairman of the Eccentric Club, which sounds pretty awesome.
They all wore bow ties.
But he boring ass club.
He put to emphasize how boring it was, he put a 100-pound challenge to be donated to charity to solve the unsolvable crossword puzzle.
Right.
So it was a boring ass club.
Yeah.
But this guy helped design this crossword puzzle, and again, the British intelligence used it, and they put on a contest, and it was part of the UK Telegraph, which is still one of the big newspapers there. But the UK Telegraph put on a contest, and they had people come, and they said, "You have 12 minutes to beat this crossword puzzle." And five people beat the crossword puzzle in 12 minutes, and all five of them got a letter saying, "Come and report to Colonel Nichols of the General Staff. He wants to talk with you." And all of them just got hired.
Right.
So a ton of people there got hired, and then they released it to the next day. They put it in the newspaper, and they said, "If you can solve it, write in." And there's still a contest going on. And then, yeah, that was how they, because he was sort of deducing that the type of thinking you have to be able to do to solve a crossword puzzle is kind of outside of the box. You have to interpret the clue, and you have to come up with stuff, and you have to think like this different way. And he made a lot of correlations between crossword puzzles, because there's a person, right? And I don't know enough about cryptography to ever get behind this, but the person called the setter who writes the crossword puzzle has a certain agenda or certain psychology or certain things that they're specialists in.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened with people who were sending messages that were encrypted through the Enigma code. So like, you would start to get to know, based on this message, it must have been written by this guy,
right?
Because of the very choices of words that he used to start the code, like shit.
We went over that in the JonBenet Ramsey, because that guy was able to look at writings and he could tell what books you read.
Right.
Like, based off your influences, the way you use certain sentences, he's like, "Oh, they read this novel." Like, that guy's crazy.
Right.
People are crazy.
No. And they, like, to the point that one of the women at Bletchley Park figured out that one of the German people who were encrypting things had a girlfriend named Rosa,
right?
Because based on back encryption, Rosa kept showing up
right.
at some names, baseline yeah. of the code, and like they could decipher these things wow. based upon the people who were setting the thing. And I also completely not really related, but a funny thing when I was reading about this crossword puzzle thing. On May 2nd and on June 1st of 1944, right before the D-Day invasion, there were crossword puzzles that came out that had the words Utah, Omaha, Overlord, Mulberry, and Neptune. Mm-hmm. And Overlord was the name of the invasion, Operation Overlord. Utah and Omaha were American beachheads. Mulberry was a British beachhead. I think Neptune was as well. So the guy who wrote these crossword puzzles got arrested and grilled because they were like, we're about to fucking invade the continent.
Yeah.
And you know our code words a right. couple days before we're launching. Because this was on May 2nd and June 1st. The invasion was on June 6th.
So how did it turn up? How did he know it?
It turns out that he was just getting words from his kids. And they were just saying, they were saying words that all of the soldiers were saying while they were drinking.
Oh, that's
because
funny.
They would just be saying, yeah, I guess I'm going to be on Utah. And someone else was like Overlord and someone else, and it was just like purely yeah. kids were overhearing this. But in theory, that was a massive security breach that's in funny. Those crossword puzzles that the Germans never found out about. But so the Enigma machine is this impossible thing. Bletchley Park gets built, and apparently Bletchley Park had multiple huts. It was based on these different huts, and
hut
I guess
one, hut two, hut three,
hut four.
They were in hut eight.
They were in hut eight, and there were only 16 huts, but they were numbered up to hut 23, which was probably some intel
trickery.
Thing. Yeah. Just some sheer trickery. One through
there
nine.
There was no
the
one.
Same. Yeah.
Eight was number one.
One through nine were right, but then everything after that, they just started skipping random numbers and assigning stuff. But yeah, he was in hut eight, which was specifically dedicated to cracking the Enigma code. And he was in charge of hut eight, and that was his whole thing. Did you guys see much about Bletchley Park from what you were looking at?
I didn't read as much about it as much as I saw of it in the movie and remember it because it's largely based around the happenings there.
Yeah,
like that, its main focus is that.
I didn't care.
And one other thing, just to
it's where he met his surprised me that he got a wife or a fiance.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Well,
so
it's what's her name?
Joan Clark.
Yeah. Joan Clark. So what happens though is
she like, worked with him in Hut 8.
He wants to recruit her though in the beginning and yeah. she's the one that passes the test and does it all fast. And that's why I was wondering how much truth there is.
I don't think that is because the what I saw was that it was just she was just a fellow mathematician that was working there and he kind of had a thing for her.
He didn't really have a thing for her. That's why I feel like the movie portrayal of it's probably more accurate. What their angle was is that her parents were super strict. She was 25, highly intelligent. Originally they had to have a cover story because they can't say what she's really doing. They're right. like, oh, you're working at a radio factory with a bunch of guys. Right. And their parents are like, nope. And so he shows up, tries to convince the parents. It's a really like prestigious radio factory.
I think that's a dramatization because his friends that were actually his good friends that right. worked with him and other mathematicians, he liked her.
So, well, no, so, they get to it. They become friends, but not in like a sexual manner. So
no, he didn't have sex at all.
Changing the story to get her to be able to work there. And at some point, she had played out the thing and she's like, look, my parents are pressuring me. I'm going to leave the program because I'm not doing anything. There's nothing coming to us. I can't say that I did this in my career. It's not right. advantageous. I'm not married yet at 25.
Right.
And for the time period, that's an important thing, especially with strict parents like that. So he says, well, what if you were married? And that's how he goes about proposing to her because they're just friends. And she's like, what do you mean? Who am I going to marry? Tom, this guy. And she's like, oh, you're proposing. And then he's like, yeah, why not? You know, we're both this and that. And so that's how that proposal goes down apparently in the movie, which
yeah,
it makes sense though.
Know.
No, they were friends though, because he even eventually admits his homosexuality to her and she's unfazed.
On the second date.
She's like, yeah, he's like,
he asked her to marry him
mm-hmm.
and then they went out the next night, like to a movie or whatever,
right.
and then told her.
Yeah. He starts to get worried. Like
he said that he had homosexual tendencies.
That sounds like much he said, she said, man.
Yeah. It all is.
Yeah. But she was unfazed. She was like, we're the same kind of people. We can have an intellectual relationship. I like you. You like me. We're yeah. friends.
Right.
We have each other's minds. We don't need the rest of it. And she wasn't worried about it.
Yeah.
And
but she didn't have a vagina.
Yeah. I think
mathematicians don't have genitals.
No, they're vaginalists. That's a term.
Yeah. But I wouldn't be surprised by the top secret nature of Bletchley Park. I mean, even like Turing was given all these awards for what he did in the war by the king himself, and all of the awards were classified because he could never talk about what he did.
You got to think about it. Like, the German U-boats were fucking kicking ass.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they were out there just destroying everything.
Yep.
And all of their code was encrypted, like, because of the Enigma machines.
And you couldn't fucking break it.
They didn't know. But once they started figuring this shit out, things started happening. The war started taking a turn. And there's a lot of claims saying that if Alan Turing didn't do what he did, that if they would have found out that he was homosexual, and maybe this was it, Brent, maybe he needed to have a wife or a fiance.
It was a double thing.
Not necessarily for her, but for him, because if the people at that place found out, at the naval base found out that he was gay, he would have been gone.
Yeah,
probably. Well, he was under suspicion of, like, never actually charged or accused, but of espionage, of possibly being a Russian spy.
Yeah.
And he's acting shady. He's hiding something, but they just didn't know that that's what he was hiding.
It's a similar thing to Alan Turing. I mean, he was constantly being busted for being a communist, and only the general in charge of it, like Groves, was like, I don't give a fuck if he's a communist.
Oppenheimer. You said Alan Turing.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Like, Oppenheimer was a communist, you know, had communist leanings.
He did have a bunch of communist ties. He did.
And the general was like, I don't give a fuck what he is. He's the only guy who can build the bomb, you know, but it's like.
This was kind of the same thing. If he wouldn't have done what he did and was able to crack the code, the Germans might well have won the war. You know?
And I wish I would have written the quote down, like, talking about the secrecy of Bletchley Park, because I read a quote and it was actually like part of this intelligence manual that the Bletchley Park people had. And it said, remember, no discussing Bletchley Park at the inn, no discussing it at the pub, no discussing it with your family, no discussing it with something else. And it even said, no discussing it in your hut. Mm-hmm. So it was like, when you're in your hut working, you still don't fucking talk about it. Damn. Like, just do your shit.
It sounds like they work at Apple. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Don't talk about the fucking iPhone. I mean, if you're working on the iPhone, you don't talk about the iPhone.
So throughout the war, what he ends up doing is he invents these crypto bombs, which are the machines that break the Enigma code. But because I was looking and it's all these things, and I was trying to, apparently he did 5 major advances to cryptanalysis during the war. He perfected the crypto bomb, which is the device that actually, the computation device that actually could figure out the Enigma code. He deduced the indicator procedure used by the German Navy, whatever the fuck that means. He came up with a statistical procedure to make better bombs. He did a 4th thing that I can't even conceive of enough to have written in my notes and talk about. And then the other thing that he did was he made the first portable secure voice scrambler, which was the first time ever he created a scrambled walkie-talkie.
And then they didn't use it, or something.
Yeah, they didn't end up using it, but he still invented it.
Right.
So he came up with a way to encrypt the frequency and a voice. So, I mean, these were the types of things that he was doing. That was Project Delilah. And he was awarded the Order of the British Empire by King George VI for his wartime services, but the work and the award were still classified I think until after he died.
Ferrari, but you can't drive it.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. So
that's even worse. Like, that's like, here's the world.
Right.
You can't be in it. Thanks
for saving the world, but fuck off. And apparently he was quite a character at Bletchley Park. There was a British historian named Ronald Lewin who said, quote, in the first weeks of June each year, he would get a bad attack of hay fever and he would cycle to the office wearing a service gas mask to keep the pollen off.
That's my favorite part. That's
Brent.
Riding his bike.
No, this whole thing. It's highlighted in orange on here because it was like my thing. Yeah.
His bicycle had a fault. The chain would come off at regular intervals. Instead of having it mended, he would count the number of times the pedal went around and he would get off the bicycle in time to adjust the chain by hand. Jesus,
an idiot.
Yeah, he would just get off and fix the chain.
And then another one of his eccentricities is that he chained his mug to the radiator pipes to prevent it from being stolen.
Yeah.
He's very actually eccentric.
That's
and shout out to listener Steve Murray, who actually said some of that stuff in our Facebook post about Alan Turing. And then I didn't believe him and looked it up myself, but he was right. So one of the things is none of this would have been possible, A, if it wasn't for Turing making his crypto bombs, and B, if they didn't get an Enigma machine, which they did in 1941.
How'd they get that?
And I looked into it because I know there was a movie called U-571.
Red October?
No, that was different. Oh. That was about the, that was different. The U-571 movie, apparently a lot of people in the UK got very pissed off because it had nothing to do with what actually happened in the movie. It's like all these like super badasses like infiltrate a sub and do all this stuff.
Steven Seagal.
That's not what fucking happened.
Right, no.
What happened is, because I was curious about this, apparently the U-boat crews, the submarine crews, had standing orders and they were fanatical about it, that anytime they thought they were going to get boarded, they thought they were going to do whatever, they had to fucking scuttle the ship because right. there were too many top secret things on there, not just the Enigma machines, but the way they ran, like everything about them. They didn't want a U-boat to fall into enemy hands. So no one ever scuttled the ship
means sink that ship.
Yeah, they would fucking sink that shit. They would all fucking abandon ship and sink that shit. So a U-boat that was surfaced, and it was called U-110, was fighting with a British destroyer, and they didn't have time to dive the U-boat. And the British destroyer went up to ramming speed because the destroyer was badass enough to ram the U-boat and sink it, but not take enough damage to sink itself.
Right.
Yeah.
So they were going ramming speed, and the captain, a guy named Fritz Lent.
Is that actually like on the like controls, like ramming like slow, speed. Medium, fast, ramming
fuck him
speed?
In the ass.
Yeah. It has like ram horns.
Right.
Like,
yeah. So the destroyer was coming in at ramming speed.
Fuck him in the ass with a sausage.
Yeah. And reportedly, Fritz Lempt ordered everyone to abandon ship because they were getting rammed and it was going to sink. And apparently his words were last stop, everybody off, like as some kind of a joke. But they had just radioed out like the ship is sinking, we're going down. Everybody abandons ship. And the commander of the British destroyer at ramming speed was able to turn just enough to pass the ship and not ram it. So all the Germans start swimming back to the U-boat and they just get fucking shot
right.
from the British soldiers who are on the deck. They either get shot or captured. The captain gets shot according to one account. On another account, he drowns.
Sank my battleship.
Yeah, you sank my battleship is right. So they end up getting on the ship. They take the Enigma machine and they fucking sink the ship.
Right.
They're like, fuck everything else. Sink it. We have an Enigma machine.
And no one knows
we have the Enigma machine. And
they already reported it was going down.
Right. And this is the fucked up part. So the ship sinks.
Who's that guy? What's his name? The destroyer captain.
I read didn't say. It didn't say his name.
To find out about him.
So he ends up getting the Enigma machine, sinking the sub.
That guy actually saved fucking everybody. Did.
Yeah, that yeah.
He got a classified award.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He got all kinds of awards.
He's still alive.
Yeah. Actually, he probably got sunk by a U-boat 3 weeks later and fucking died a freezing cold, terrifying death. But so they get the Enigma machine, and then with the crypto bomb, they're able to break the code. And this has always been the most fucked up part of this, and there's no way getting around it. Once they broke the Enigma code, and they had all the people at Bletchley Park, just hundreds, thousands of codes coming in a day that they were deciphering, that they were like back engineering and using their crypto bomb to figure out. Because even though they had the machine, they still needed this computer to fucking.
They still couldn't
crack it.
You didn't know what it was.
But once they had the code, they still had to act as if they didn't have the code.
Yeah.
And that was the fucked up part. They would get a message, such and such town is going to get bombed tomorrow at noon. And they were like, well, I guess that town's getting bombed.
Yeah.
Like, as if we evacuate the town, the Germans know we cracked the code.
There's a super dramatic scene where one of the guys that's actually on the code breaking team.
It didn't happen.
In the Hut 8, where like his brother's on the boat. He's like, my brother's on that boat. Like, that's about to get
too
hit.
Bad, man.
Yeah, and 150 civilians on some other thing.
Well, that shit happened all. Like, that was the nature of it.
Yeah,
like,
and
we
the
broke
Titanic
the code,
sunk.
And
yeah.
we can't like, fucking say shit.
Well, you have to do small things here and there. Yeah.
Right. I mean, we have to save it for massive intel, right? Like, the point is, we can coordinate D-Day, so we can invade the continent. We need the code to pull that off. The rest of it is bullshit. Like, so all kinds of shit happen.
I mean, this is already not safe for Jew times right now.
Absolutely. This is the epitome of not safe for Jew times. So, so they crack the code and they have to sit on it. And then at that point, Bletchley Park is still crucial because even though they crack it, they've got one Enigma machine, they've got the crypto bombs, and they're sitting there deciphering hundreds, thousands of messages a day. day coming over the Enigma machines that they have to figure out and
wonder if anybody like kryptonized their lunch. You know what I mean? They sent across like, I'm going to have me a sub sandwich today.
Yeah. They're sending love notes and stuff.
Fritz, yeah. I'm having schnitzel at noon.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Would you like to join me, Fritz? You know, we'll play some rugby.
So the way they cracked the code, though, at least in the movie, was because they needed some known text. That's what it was based off of. Because still, they were running the machine, and nothing would happen. And it goes back to what you're saying, which makes me think it's true. He was saying that they could identify that they had a counterpart that they were talking to, and that Rose a girlfriend thing that everyone
there's
had.
There's keywords.
They had to have the keywords. And so someone had gotten a hold of a copy of one decrypted message or a couple decrypted messages from like a year or so before, and they were like, oh, look at this. Every day they have this like noon weather broadcast thing that they do, and at the end of
it's
it
the
they
same
say
thing or something.
Hail Hitler at the end of it. And so they're like, holy shit, because they know that at noon they know this many letters, and
right,
like, if we know this many letters, yeah, so they go,
fuck,
they punch that shit and it goes from 159 million million to like it drops it dramatically, and they start that shit up and it's just like cogs turning, like clink 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 clink. And they're like, holy shit. They pull it out. They go type in the Enigma machine, and it's like longitude, latitude. And they're like, we fucking got it. Like,
because it was of Hail Hitler.
Because they used that terminology. And there was a joke because Turing didn't speak German. And originally, he almost didn't get put in the position. Because like, how are you going to break German code? You don't even speak German.
Yeah.
And so his...
He's like, I know the schnitzel.
His thing at the end was, it turns out the only German you need to know to break the Enigma code
is Hail Hitler.
Hail Hitler.
Yeah.
Hail Hitler.
Yeah. So the... From one thing that I read, it said that basically operator mistakes, procedural flaws, and a lack of changing the code as frequently as they should have were as important in breaking the code as getting the machine and building this device, which is crazy because they were changing it multiple times a day.
Right.
And they were like, that's not enough. Like, you should have changed it more often than that, because that's what let us. I mean, I couldn't conceive of how the machine worked in order to get those millions of fucking varieties, much less to be able to outthink that fucking machine. And because that's even one of the things, like with modern day encryption, they say the same thing, like modern day encryption is to this fucking nth degree, and it's going to take millions of years to crack these encrypted.
Well, you know how an algorithm works. I mean, it's just like in the pattern, it's like the third number will be four times the fourth number minus the eighth number divided by one, you know, whatever it is.
But algorithms now are like. Fucking millions of characters long.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem is. Like,
this shit made me get all crazy. Like, I'm sure I'm fucking wrong, but I have this crazy idea. And I know that nothing will come of it because there's no way Brent in the basement thought of this, but I have some weird idea for like limitless compression. And I'm going to draw it on a whiteboard at some point in time with a bottle of whiskey in one of my hands and a dry erase marker in the other. And I'm sure nothing will come of it, or it's already been invented, but I have an idea. And
can you have like Kramer hair at the same time?
Yes.
Like, you gotta,
it's fucking, it's too much to explain here, but yeah, I don't own a lab coat.
A lab coat will give you a bonus.
I say you just wear a G-string. G-string and a bottle of whiskey and a fucking marker and just have your hair all crazy.
Well, G-string is more comfortable though, because I don't, clothes hurt me. Like when I trim my nails and stuff, it hurts. Yeah.
So I would get a G-string and a
I need to get Howard Hughes versus Turing versus I got to get a little.
You could be in
MMA,
a lab coat.
The MMA of crazy.
No, you'd be in a lab coat, and when you turn around to tell whoever's there watching, you're in a G-string.
Danger fields.
Yeah, the danger fields are just on the
I just have a ball flap
side.
That's still Velcroed up from earlier. Yeah. Balls are just out of the ball flap in the lab coat.
That's funny.
Yes, it is. Did you guys see that when he got called to meetings in London, sometimes he would just run the 40 miles?
No.
Yeah, when he was required to attend an important meeting.
He liked running.
He would just run the 40 miles to the meeting.
He had to stay
40
fit.
Miles.
He had to stay fit for his 17-year-old boyfriend.
I barely ran the mile in high school, man. I did it in 6:35. I can't do it now.
That's
pretty good. I'd probably do it in fucking 20:35. I don't know.
I'd fucking drive 40 minutes and have to stop for a Mountain Dew in the middle. Like, fuck. Fuck. Running.
No shit. I don't even want to drive 40
Jesus
miles.
Christ.
That's the truth.
It's just like 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's long enough for a Dew stop. That's all I'm saying.
Do stop.
You wouldn't understand.
Someone remind me next week, Infinite Compression, though. I'm going to forget my idea. I need to write this shit down because it's kind of
You
like,
have paper and a pen right
it's
now.
It's complicated, though. I can't even really write. I have like the concept in my brain. It's based off like levels of encrypted algorithms. And like there's a decrypted key that tells you what level you're at for the encryption so that it always keeps reducing it down to like four
digits.
Are you
going to be able to fit it into all the socks or no?
No, the problem that will happen is the decryption side of it will be huge, but the compression side can be super small because it's based off of layers of encryption that require this large amount of information on the host computer to decrypt the encrypted because it knows what level of encryption it is. And so it references lines to say this is level 53 encryption. So then decode 53, which goes to level 52 and further on. It's
are weird. They like, well, so they're going to have to be like knee high socks then.
What are the socks about?
I'm glad that that's what you took from that conversation.
Yeah.
What are the socks about?
They're compression socks.
Oh.
Yeah, knee high, like to the calf compression.
Yeah, man, I'll name my diabetes socks, man. I'll have diabetes socks.
Diabetes socks.
A lab coat with a ball flap.
There is a lot of encryption that goes into the diabetes socks.
That's true. Maybe. Yeah. And if every so often you just say, Marty, then I think you'll get another bonus. Yeah. To your mad scientist madness.
I'm going to do it's happening in that room, just so you know. That way, if my balls are out, no one's offended. I'm going to do it in the next room over. I got to clean it up a little bit.
Now, you got to leave it messy. So you trip over shit.
Yeah, that's like, true.
That's it. Yeah, the bar's exactly, still on the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, like, an Apple computer will hit you in the head, and it'll give you the way to solve the problem.
I thought Brad was retarded, but socks is the answer.
Socks, that's it.
My kitten socks.
Yeah.
Static he said knee high and it threw me off. They got to be thigh high.
Like the midget.
Where's my G-string?
G-string theory.
Yeah. So, oh, Jesus Christ.
Theory on a string.
So the war ends and again, he gets sort of secret. He gets a secret ticker tape parade by the king alone in
the
bedroom.
You saved like,
ticker tape. You always hear that. Ticker tape parade.
Ticker tape parade. It was because in New York, if there was a big parade when they would go down Wall
put
Street,
up the tape
like a ticker would be what counts off like Wall Street numbers. And it would be ticking off like this sheet of paper tape. It wasn't really
counting
tape.
It
was like stock prices.
Oh, okay. Ticker tape.
And all the buildings had these machines that would spew out. Like if you look at the readout right now,
I think
now
they
the
still
bottom.
Call a stock ticker. I think they still call
they
it
still
a ticker.
Call it the ticker. Yeah,
at the bottom of the news. You
but
know,
like in New York, if they were having a big parade that was like a big hero came up, everybody would put the tickers by the window, and all the ticker tape would just go
shoot them out,
spitting out of the window, and it would be like confetti falling down on people.
Confetti falling down on people.
Ticker tape parade. Okay. The Turing didn't
during
get one.
During 9/11, it wasn't tape though. It was people jumping out of the buildings.
Ooh. It wasn't a parade. So
damn it.
Yeah. So post-war, from 45 to 47, Turing works at the National Physics Library, and he starts working on ACE, which is the automatic computing engine. So even the first computer had a really stupid name.
Mm-hmm. Boring.
Yeah, but he starts working on the first genuine computer.
I do like his theory, though. He thought that that because of how we thought and that neurons would be able to think, you know what I mean? To make choices and decisions and all that stuff, that's how he worked it into like a machine could do that. Like resistors could do that. Like the way he thought was just different, you know, and he thought about computers that way.
Yeah.
Which was interesting, you know,
and
like
when
nobody
no one
was
is thinking
that.
About computers. I mean, so that was 45 and 47, 48. He becomes, he's appointed to the mathematics department at Victoria University in Manchester. He becomes the deputy director of the computing machine laboratory in 1949, where they work on software for one of the earliest stored program computers, which was the Manchester Mark One. And then in 1950, one of the things aside from the Bletchley Park stuff that he's most famous for is he writes a paper in 1950 called Computing Machinery and Intelligence in a journal called Mind. And in this paper in 1950 is when he theorizes artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Well ahead of anyone else talking about this, he's saying these computers that can't do shit based on the architecture that we have with enough power, with enough advances. There's no reason this thing cannot be intelligent.
Because the question arises, at what point is it thinking? It's right. coming to decisions. It's solving problems.
Right.
And so that's where the Turing test comes in. They're like,
can it
when is a computer thinking?
Yeah. Right.
And when is it just... You know,
it's pretty close. They think now, like, I mean, they have all the knowledge.
And we still, to this day, I mean, in 1950, he came up with the Turing test in this paper and in a nutshell, and I'm pretty sure we've talked about it in other episodes, but the Turing test is if you have a live person and a computer and they're both in a separate room.
Can you tell them apart?
And you can ask questions, but you can't necessarily hear a voice. So let's just say that, like, you ask a question and 2 minutes later, a piece of paper comes in with an answer typed right. on it. Like, so you can't hear a voice. You don't see the person.
There's no handwriting. Yeah.
Right. There's no handwriting. But just based on the content of it, if you reach a point where you cannot tell the difference between the person and the computer, that computer is intelligent.
You know, it's relevant. That's today, like the CAPTCHA, the security CAPTCHAs that you see on the internet when you have to type in like these, what do you see on the screen?
Somebody's house address or something.
Yeah, it's a house address or something muddled that a computer couldn't determine probably, which I find hard to believe. I definitely think a computer could see that 1405
given,
street
given
address.
The software, it could.
Given the software, it could. I just think the average shitheel hacker isn't going to have the software that can pull that
off. So, but that CAPTCHA is based off the Turing test. It's basically trying to determine that you're not a computer just randomly signing up for accounts or whatever, that you're actually physically seeing and typing it.
Up until now, nothing has passed the Turing test. There are, I mean, we could do a whole thing on AI. There are people like John Searle who say the Turing test will never happen, that an intelligent computer can't exist, etc. But Alan Turing from the get-go says, yes, it can. It's just a matter of time.
What about what's the Jeopardy computer again?
Watson.
Watson, that thing.
That motherfucker.
Yeah, does that not pass the test?
I don't know.
Maybe it's given.
I don't think it does.
Maybe it's given its.
Or Siri at this fucking point. Like, you know.
I don't know, man. That's what I'm saying. Now, well, if you had nowadays, like.
If you had a conversation with it, though, you would still. I mean, you could ask a question. Computer, like, you know.
I don't know. Like, there's some retards that probably couldn't answer as good as Siri. You know
well, no, that definitely. I mean, that definitely. I mean, that's definitely. That's a count. I mean, that is a counter argument for it, is that there are humans who couldn't pass the Turing test.
Yeah.
I mean, quite honestly. But
no, they're
but
a computer.
The fact of the matter is, I mean, I don't know. I don't think Siri could fool you into thinking it was actually a person.
By retards,
I think if it was
designed, mouth breathers, like just stupid people. Right. I didn't mean.
I think. I think if it was designed to be that way, I think it could.
And then that gets into a whole other question. People then say, well, if you've just designed it to mimic human behavior, that doesn't necessarily mean it's intelligent. That just means it knows how to mimic human behavior. And then a lot of people say, well, who gives a fuck at that point? What's the difference?
Yeah, I think it's getting there because if it can learn your mannerisms and your behaviors, like you could say, like, you can tell Siri, like, hey, this person is my sister. And then when you say, call my sister, it calls your sister. Like, it knows. It stores information. It stores data.
Yeah, we're
and
so
it, and
close.
It gets to know. Like, yeah, I think it's going to
I mean,
be
the,
there.
The closest thing that I read was when they when Google built its AI bot based on reading movie scripts. And I think we talked about it in a previous episode.
It got all mean
and when
power.
The person was asking about ethics and morality, and the computer kept saying, I don't know what morals are. I don't know what ethics are. And eventually it got pissed off and said, this conversation is over, and quit talking. That was about as close, because that to me is starting to get to a point where that wasn't in the programming. Like,
you just got pissed off at me
and
honestly,
quit talking.
Why does it care about redundancy?
Right.
It would have just kept saying, I don't understand. Yeah.
Right.
I don't understand.
But there, something in there.
I don't know. Like, they might have had like if then fucking
sure.
If,
but I mean,
responses
things like that are going to have to happen to me to pass the Turing test.
Have
I'm going to have to have. I'm going to have a response that's like, I asked it, what did he eat for lunch? And it says your mom. And it's like, I mean, you're like,
like, whoa.
Like, you're going to be like, that's a person. And then you find out it's the computer and you're like, oh shit, that was a good
then
one.
Then you find out that I programmed it and just says your mom to every answer.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's going to have some off the cuff shit. It's going to have humor. It's going to have empathy. It's going to have to do some weird
I think the Turing test is outdated. I think that if a computer can think, doesn't mean that it has to have emotion. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't matter.
I agree.
Like, I wouldn't want to be able to tell a computer from a person. Like, that has no relevance to me.
I think it play. I The error to me is I think the Turing test places too much value on human intelligence.
Exactly.
I think we could have an intelligent, sentient computer that doesn't act in any way like a human being.
It's going to act like a computer.
It's not
going
to pass.
It doesn't have feelings. Right. It doesn't have morality.
Like case in point, Alan Turing, like he was a super logical guy that didn't get sarcasm.
He was
like,
almost
he didn't get normal conversation. Right. Like the guys in the movie, they're like, hey, we're going to lunch. He's like, okay. Hey, I said we're going to lunch. Okay. We're going to lunch. He's like, okay. He's like, I just asked you if you want to go to lunch. No, you didn't.
No, you didn't. You said we're going, not me.
Like, he's like, oh my God. He's like, so if anyone's hungry, he's like, I'm hungry. Could I have some soup, please? And they're just like, they just shake their head and
walk. Maybe when we talked
about Turing pass the Turing test? That's my point.
That's a good question.
Yeah. When we talked about, they would think he's a fucking computer. Yeah.
No, people on both ends, like a super high or a super low intelligence vector might not pass the Turing test. You'd be like, that's not a fucking
human. Even a level one white guy.
Tier one. Come on.
There's tiers. Come on. Maybe we talk about this on the Apple episode, but it's the Apple with the bite out of it's referring to a tribute to Turing. We didn't get to that part yet.
I know, but I was just saying that.
Like, I didn't realize that.
Oh, damn.
There's a reason why.
Maybe we didn't say that, but that's coming up.
Yeah, it's coming up.
No, I'm saying on the Apple episode because I don't ever remember that coming up because when you were like, hey, let's talk about Alan Turing, I'm like, who the fuck's Alan Turing?
Right.
I have no idea, which I probably should have, but I just never heard of him.
Right.
So,
well, both Steve Jobs and the logo designer say it has nothing to do with it, but there's a pretty strong argument based off him being the father of computers and artificial intelligence and the events that are about
Apple
to
stuff
unfold.
That are about it. Yeah. So one other thing before that, though, in 1952, and again, this just shows the level of his intelligence, he did work on what they call mathematical biology. And he basically predicted facts that had to exist about DNA mathematically based on observing biological things. And this was years before DNA. What was DNA? And I want to say 55.
I don't know.
Someone's going to say, you were wrong. It was not 55.
Yeah.
But in 52, before DNA was discovered, he he predicted it math-fucking-matically. That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
like
he had to have had it.
The level of intelligence on this guy is just fucking off the dials. But again, this whole time he's homosexual. And in January of 1952, his house, and I'm going to use the proper British term, is burgled.
Burgled?
His flat. House.
His flat.
I'm going to say one thing real quick. In 1950,
flat is burgled.
He helps program a chess program, but they don't have any computers powerful enough to run the program that he made for the chess.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So they run a match against a really good chess player, but he has to sit there and hand write out the logical progression of what the program would have done.
This is what it would have said.
But it took 30 minutes for each move. To do it by hand because a computer was going to do it and just make the move, but the computer would crash when it tried to run the program because it wasn't powerful enough.
Didn't have enough.
So he sat there and handed the logic of this is where the computer would have moved. And it took 30 minutes per move and he lost. But it did beat the chess player's wife because women were inferior at that time. Yeah. So he wasn't good.
That's crazy. Yeah. So on January 23rd, his house is burgled and he's just started dating a new boyfriend, a guy named Arnold Murray, who was 19. Turing was in his late 30s, I want to say.
Yeah.
But the police investigation basically discovered that one of Arnold Murray's friends was the one that broke into the house. And through the investigation, they discovered that they were gay. And they were both charged with gross indecency under Section 11 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885 because homosexuality was a crime.
Persecutable. So
they're charged with gross indecency.
In the 50s. This is crazy. This is
52.
The sentence is crazy.
Yeah. So he gets
on. He couldn't be black either.
He gets tried on March 31st. He gets tried and convicted of being fucking homosexual. And he's given the choice of jail time or hormonal treatment to reduce his libido.
And it wasn't like, here, take these pills and you could fucking put them under your tongue and spit them out. It was an injection they administered.
Yeah. So
estrogen.
They injected. It was called stilboestrol, which was a synthetic estrogen.
Yep.
It caused impotence and gynecomastia, which is, according to Fight Club, bitch tits.
Yep.
He's unable to have sex. And this is the punishment he gets for being homosexual.
Turn him into a woman.
At the same time, he probably didn't want to have sex because
no,
his libido was crap.
Right, like, exactly.
He said that they, he told his friends that they were just like masturbating pretty much, like masturbating to each other.
And here's the thing. Arnold Murray gets let off.
Yeah.
The 19-year-old unemployed fucking shit heel gets let off.
Yeah.
And the guy who wins World War II gets fucking chemical castration. Thanks.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Jesus fucking Christ. So everything that
I love that phrase. That is the best phrase.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Jesus was trying to help people and they fucking crucified him.
Now, everything that I had read, and now this has been put into doubt for me anyway, is that on June 8th, 1954, and June 8th is my birthday, so I have a connection here. June 8th, 1954, he's found dead from cyanide poisoning, and there is a half-eaten apple next to his bed, which is why people say that the Apple logo has something to do with Alan Turing. And everyone said that he killed himself because of the chemical castration and because of all this different stuff, but then actually one of our listeners, Eddie... I have Eddie Garcy written here in my notes. If I said it wrong, sorry, Eddie, but get a name that's easier to pronounce.
Brad was going to fuck you up anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Dave took care of it.
What happened? I wasn't paying attention.
That's all right. But he pointed this out, so I looked into it to see what new theory had come about. And most people think it was a suicide. He killed himself. But there's a lot of evidence coming out that it wasn't a suicide. It was just an accidental poisoning death.
Right.
And he had a room that he himself called the Nightmare Room, where he would do experiments with gold-plated alloys conducting electricity, working towards computation and all that kind of stuff. And you had to use cyanide in order to get the gold to bond to different metals. And they think that it was either that there was an aerosol of cyanide that he breathed in that was just slowly poisoning him,
his skin or something,
or that he accidentally had it on his skin and touched the apple or whatever. But a lot of people think, because they look at it and they're like, 4 days before his suicide, he had a tea party for some neighbors. He had a to-do list on his desk at work for Monday when he got back to work.
Right.
No one reported signs of depression.
No one tested the apple.
So
there were reports from his friends that he had passed, talked about suicide, and there was like some suicidal things going on with him over the years.
But like at this time,
no,
nothing was,
but
nothing was
there's
happening.
There's a bunch of stuff that floated around that said that the Secret Service also was involved and probably might have poisoned him, maybe by accident,
might have tinfoil.
There's also like a spin around to say that he did it for a plausible deniability for his mom, so she would have like a, he didn't do it, it was that, like, so he could kill himself and make his mom feel better. Like,
right.
So she at least would feel better.
Yeah, there's nobody knows.
Right. So. He's dead one way or the other.
I heard there was a pigeon in the room, though.
That's his U-boat.
Laser pigeon was
his U-boat sunk.
Yeah. So he did end up with, like, in 2009, the government apologized and gave him a pardon.
Yeah,
that was nice of him. Thanks.
What?
Yeah.
A pardon for what?
For being gay.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they pardoned him for his homosexual crime. And
so
this
is Britain, right?
They officially
Or did the US pardon him?
No, it was overseas.
Jesus Christ, bunch of fucking idiots.
And I'm hesitant to say it was Britain because on our Facebook page people got in an argument about whether or not it was the UK or it was Britain. Because it's different and I don't want to.
I'm not going to comment any further on that either. Didn't he live in Britain?
We lived in London. Or he lived in Manchester.
You're about to start the argument.
Yeah, we're about to start the argument.
That's good. Fuck
people out there. People.
Actually, don't we have a family that lives in the UK? Why can't they tell us? The UK Brady Bunch.
You'd have to read the argument to understand why. It's not worth arguing.
It's not to us.
Somebody said England, and he said you mean Britain because there's more
Brad's
than one.
Insisted on bringing it in.
Yeah, and then I was like, no, I didn't comment, but I was like, no, it's Egypt, obviously. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
Egypt is the place to be.
Yes.
But
they're in denial.
Jesus Christ. Why did you laugh?
Because he liked it.
That was a groan, not a laugh. That was
my daughter told me a funny joke this week. She said, "Hey, Dad, did you see that new movie about constipation?" I said, "No." She said, "That's because it didn't come out yet."
Oh, that's a good one.
She's 12 though, so that's good.
Dave didn't get that one. His all came out.
Yeah, mine all came out this week. But I mean, at the end of the day, there are 23 major like worldwide universities that have honors named after him, statues up, fellowships in his name.
That statue was confusing. It was made out of
hard on.
It was 1.5 tons, and it said it was made out of something crazy, out of like 1,500 pieces of something. And I was like, how do they carve it? It says a 1.5 ton life-size statue of Turing was unveiled, and then it was made out of 1,500 pieces of fucking something that I can't find while we're recording.
You're all reading. You're reading it. It's I thought you were reading it. You're saying it all slowly like you were reading
it. Well, all I know, I don't know what the material was called, but they got it from Uranus.
Yes.
Did they? That was extra dense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is the rough and tumble.
No. Oh. Built out of 500,000 pieces of Welsh slate. Did they fucking glue it together?
Slate?
Yeah, it looks like it.
Yeah.
No, look, if you look at the, it's like ridged. It's like layer upon layer.
Oh.
Like when you look at, because I wondered why it looked like that. It's like different layers stacked on top of each other. Maybe they carved each piece of slate and glued it to the one above and below. I have no idea, man. That's fucking
crazy. They better
have
made a fucking Turing bomb machine.
That's jacked up. The one of them sitting on the bench, he's holding an apple.
Oh, that's
just that's like a troll. Who made that one? He's like sitting on a bench and he's holding an apple.
In the movie, they didn't tell how he did it in the end or whatever. But he showed up to the office one day and gave everyone apples. Which is kind of weird.
Wow. No, that is kind of weird.
Because he was trying to make friends.
But that was the other thing. I don't think the movie was very accurate.
But that was the other thing is they even like the historian like said that like his housekeeper and stuff said that he always ate an apple before bedtime because people were like, oh, he poisoned an apple and ate it. And they were like, no, he always ate an apple right before he went to bed.
That is my peanut butter and apple.
I think his mom killed him. I already called who killed JonBenet Ramsey. So. Mm-hmm. The brother did it, and then they came out with it. So I'm saying his mom killed him.
It's like how you have real theories now. You quit blaming.
I thought you were going to blame Gary Coleman. Yeah.
No. He was on the U-boats and stuff.
Oh,
but
he was the guy who burgled their flat.
He did burgle the flat. Yeah.
So that's Alan Turing.
I mean, he loved driving the little tiny cars that they had. Little three-wheel cars fit him just perfect.
What?
The little three-wheel, little tiny cars that they have over in Britain.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Never seen it, no.
You're on your own on that one. So yeah, that's Alan Turing. Like I said, everybody gives Oppenheimer all the props for developing the nuke, and they talk about the nuclear age, which is obviously important, and it looms over our heads because it could destroy us all at any minute. But I think the computer age has revolutionized our life more than anything else has. I mean, your cell phone is based on the architecture that Turing came up with during World War II and before World War II, which I mean, technically it was all stuff that Babbage came up with in the 1800s anyway. But
you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't think it was very common, though. That shit was on, like, American Pickers on one episode. I saw that.
Yeah. Well, Gary Coleman had one, okay? He was driving around.
I believe you.
It had an ice cream truck speaker on it.
So that's Turing. I do need to see Imitation Game. I've heard it's a really good.
Everybody should watch
And that's
that.
What the Turing, like, the in the Turing test, the reason it has that name is the Turing test where you're trying to tell whether or not it's a person or a computer. He calls that the Imitation Game.
Right.
Whether or not.
The name of the paper he wrote for that theory. Is the name of the paper was the Imitation Game?
No,
I think so.
No,
I don't think so.
It's called Computational Minds.
Ernst Schachendong.
I said it earlier. I'm too lazy to look back through my.
No,
notes.
That was the something problem that he saw.
Well, no, that's another German, one too.
Yeah, there is a bunch of.
I will
shit.
Look. You're gonna force me to look. It was in 1950.
You better say sponsors because I'm cutting it off.
Computing machinery and intelligence.
All right. Thank you to El Yucateco Hot Sauce. It's on the internet, people. If you can't find it at Walmart or Target, just Google it. You can get it. It's delicious, and you should. Thank you to PrintDirtCheap.com and Brad shivering off whiskey over there and doing a whiskey dance. Thank you to Digital Creations, Dark Side Graphics, and thank you to Dan Camrio Jiu-Jitsu. Log on to armhunter.com for gis and stretchy pants and booty shorts and all kinds of stuff with the logo on there. And a shout out
a lab
to
coat.
Float Indigo and all those dudes in Phuket, Thailand. Just cause.
And the UK Brady Bunch. Like go UK Brady Bunch.
Beat Britain. Family.
Where are they from? The Beat Family?
The Beat Family from Birmingham.
Yep.
I think I said that right.
Birmingham. Alabama.
Yes. Birmingham, Alabama, UK.
Yep.
Is that there? Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm about to go visit. They still like black people there?
I think so.
Okay. Cool. All right. I gotta go.
Let's go.
You sure? You sure? Any more sponsors we can get everybody?
I think that's it.
You check?
Nope.
Check your notes.
I don't have notes.
All right. Don't be retarded. Bucka, 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 bucka. Ha. You know the deal. This is me, though. Beast by Supremo for all of my people, Negroes and Latinos, and even the gringos. Yo, check it, one for Charlie Hustle, two for Steady Rock, three for the four coming live, future shot. It's five dimensions, six senses, seven firmaments of heaven to hell, 8 million stories to tell, nine planets faithfully keep an orbit with the probable tenth. The universe expands length, the body of my text possess extra strength, power lifted powerless, up out of this towering inferno, my ink so hot it burned through the journal. I'm blacker than midnight on Broadway and Myrtle. Hip hop past all your tall social hurdles, like the nationwide projects, prison industry complex, working class poor, better keep your alarm set. Streets too loud to ever hear freedom ring. Say it back in with your sleep. It's dangerous to dream, but your chain cats get the chip. You dead now. Killing fields need blood to graze the cash cow. So numbers game, but shit don't add up somehow. Like I got 16 to 32 bars to rock it, but only 15% of profits ever seen my pockets. Like 69 billion in the last 20 years spent on national defense, but folks still live in fear. Like nearly half of America's largest cities is one quarter black. That's why they gave Ricky Ross all the crap. 16 ounces to a pound, 20 more to a key, a 5 minute sentence here and then you're no longer free. 40% of Americans own a cell phone, so they can hear everything that you say when you ain't home. I guess Michael Jackson was right, you are not alone. Rock your hard hat black as you in the terror dome. Full of hard niggas, large niggas, dice tumblers, young teens of prison greens facing life numbers. Crack mothers, crack babies, and AIDS patients. Young bloods can't spell, but they can rock you a PlayStation. Snoop Mav is whipping motherfuckers ass. You wanna know how to rhyme, you better learn how to add. It's mathematics.
Mighty most definitely.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
Mighty most definitely.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
One
universal law, but two sides to every story. Three strikes and you bitten for life, mandatory. Four MCs murdered in the last 4 years. I ain't trying to be the fifth when the millennium is here. Yo, it's 6 million ways to die from the seven deadly thrills. 8 year olds getting found with 9 mils. It's 10 p.m. where your C's at. What's the deal? They on the hill pumping krills to keep their bellies filled. Lighting the ass with heavy steel. Sights on the pretty shit in life. Young soldiers trying to earn their next strike. When the average minimum wage is 5.15, you best believe you gotta find a new grind to get cream. The white unemployment rate is nearly more than triple for black. So frontliners got their gun in your back. Bubble and crack, jewel theft and robbery to combat poverty and end up in the global jail economy. Stiffer stipulations attached to each sentence. Budget cutbacks but increased police presence. And even if you get out of prison, still living, join the other 5 million under state supervision. This is business. No faces, just lines and statistics. From your phone, your zip code, the SSI digits. The system break man, channeling women in the figures. Two columns for who is and who ain't niggas. Numbers is hard to feel and they never have feelings. But you push too hard, even numbers got limits. Why did one straw break the camel's back? Here's the secret. The million other straws underneath it. It's all mathematics.
Mighty most definitely.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
Mighty most
definitely. It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
Mathematics, 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 mathematics.